Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, August 14th, 2026. Our first story on page one is about Illinois State University, headlined ISU Move-In, Make It Work. Students, families, and staffers orchestrate the arrival in rain. This story is datelined Normal. Whether it was with a sunny attitude or gritted teeth endurance, incoming Illinois State University students, their families, and staff members worked through the pouring rain and organized chaos of move-in on Wednesday at the Normal campus. We just said, you know what, we've got to do it anyway, whether it's raining or sunny or hot, so let's just roll with the weather and make it work, said Jamie LaFosse of Springfield as she dropped off her daughter, Addison, a freshman early childhood education major at Watterson Towers. Rain touched down in Normal and a little before 10 a.m. on the second day of ISU's move-in week. Roughly 6,600 students were scheduled to move into ISU's residential housing through Saturday. Fall semester classes begin the following Monday. Jennifer Waller of Plainfield, who brought her daughter Ava to Watterson, said the staff members on hand were courteous and responsive despite working under heavy rainfall. During the week, Fell Avenue will be southbound only from North Street to West Beaufort Street. Fell between Mulberry Street and West College Avenue will be closed for move-in traffic. In addition to Watterson Towers at the corner of Fell Avenue and Beaufort Street, ISU has the Hewitt Manchester and Tri Towers Residence Hall complexes and the Cardinal Court and Fell School Apartments. Drivers who are not participating in move-in activities should avoid the area. Despite the half inch of rain reported in Normal by the National Weather Service in Lincoln, Bridget Reland, Senior Associate Director of Residential Life at ISU, said the university was well prepared for the weather. Staff kind of let us know before we started move-in that this weather was on its way, Reland said. We usually have tents out here in front of Watterson, and we have our check-in tables out here, but we immediately pivoted to have them in the interior. Volunteers also had about 5,000 ponchos and 200 tarps to distribute. Volunteers wore red ponchos so families could recognize them and ask questions. Students were given white ponchos. Although some families showed up late to their assigned check-in times, Reland said there were no scheduling issues on Wednesday. We did get a few calls to our main office saying, hey, can I come a little later, Reland said. And of course, we said to please be safe, do whatever you need to, and just show up when you can show up. Waller said her husband already wrapped Ava's things with plastic, and they had their own ponchos in case the weather was bad. Everyone on the property today has been awesome, kind, and did it with a smile, Waller said. Ava, an incoming freshman, first visited ISU upon the recommendation of her dad, who is an alumnus. She plans to major in exercise science after she developed a love for sports medicine and athletic training. I really fell in love with the quad because I came here in the fall and the spring, and it's just really nice here, Ava said. LaFosse also said the ISU staff has been great since her daughter first toured the university, and she was grateful for the ponchos. Jennifer Sparty of Sandwich arrived in town with her son, Daniel, a sophomore political science major, a little late on account of the weather. She said she was thrilled that volunteers not only offered dollies to help move students' possessions, but also supplied ponchos and tarps. I was very surprised that they did and very pleased that they did that, Sparty said. Outside of the weather, Reland said one of the biggest concerns among students was how the living space was laid out and what they should be packing. We usually tell people, don't pack for your entire year and don't pack for the winter season, she said. Pack for what the weather is like now and you can hopefully go home. And Wednesday afternoon, the National Weather Service predicted that thunderstorms would be likely on Thursday, showers likely on Friday, and a chance of thunderstorms on Saturday. Our next front page story is headlined, Flock Scandals Prompt Changes. camera maker responds to police abuse reports. This story is from USA Today. As law enforcement agencies across the nation continue to use controversial license plate readers, a leading company behind the tech says a new update is intended to crack down on police officers who misuse the data. Flock Safety announced the news Thursday after a slew of high-profile cases that allege misuse of the system, such as police officers running searches not tied to law enforcement investigations, including to stalk or harass someone. Flock faces mounting pushback from citizens across the political spectrum over privacy, along with instances of vandalism and protests by those who oppose how ubiquitous the cameras have become across the United States. Critics have sprawling concerns about privacy and surveillance, but Flock is focusing on officers who misuse data in this update. In an interview with USA Today, CEO Garrett Langley said Flock Safety is taking a stand against police abuse of power and for the privacy that citizens expect. New measures that rolled out Thursday will help put a stop to police misusing the system and send up flags for any attempted misuse, he claimed. You will get caught, Langley said in a message to law enforcement seeking to use Flock for unsanctioned activity. The company's cameras are installed within the jurisdiction of more than 6,000 law enforcement agencies in the country. Flock says it has 120,000 cameras in 49 states. They are used to track vehicles' license plates, models, makes, and colors, so authorities can search a database for the exact movements of any car anytime it is picked up by a camera. Chad Marlowe, senior policy counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union, previously told USA Today that the technology raises concerns about government overreach on the right and worries about who is being targeted on the left. There's different reasons, but everyone is arriving at the same position, which is mass government surveillance in this country has gotten completely out of control and needs to be reined in immediately, Marlowe said. A Georgia police chief was arrested in November and accused of using automated license plate readers to harass and stalk people. He was found dead by suicide before he could stand trial, the Washington Post reported. An officer at another Georgia police department was also arrested for using Flock's system for non-law enforcement purposes, the Georgia Bureau of Investigations announced on August 7th. The city of Chandler, Arizona, announced on August 7th that it will discontinue its contract with Flock after it detected an anomaly in the use of its cameras. The Pinal County Sheriff's Office, also in Arizona, said it also decided not to renew its contract, citing concerns about the Fourth Amendment, which protects Americans against unreasonable searches and seizures. In Apache Junction, Arizona, a police officer resigned after he was investigated for allegedly using his department's Flock cameras to track his wife and asking another department to check its system's cameras to do a welfare check on her, reported the Arizona Republic. A North Carolina police officer was charged with one count of unlawfully using computers after allegedly using her department's license plate reader system to look up the vehicle of her boyfriend's ex-wife 31 times, including twice while off-duty, WBTV reported August 5th. The officer, Elizabeth Snowman, was accused of inputting bogus reasons for her searches into the system, including traffic infractions and burglary. Another North Carolina officer faces a similar charge for conducting an unauthorized license plate search, the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation said in July. Langley said the identification of police misuse of Flock has gone up since earlier this year, when the company rolled out its audit assistance tool, which flags abnormal searches by law enforcement for review. But until now, the tool was optional, and only about one-third of law enforcement clients turned it on. Going forward, it will be universally implemented, he said. As we now go from one-third of our customers to all of our customers having it, I think we will find new forms of abuse programmed that into the system to prevent it happening again, he said. On Thursday, Flock Safety announced that it will implement the new features to weed out bad actors in police departments and stop the misuse of its systems. They are. Every vehicle search will require a reason. Law enforcement personnel will have to input a specific case code tied to the investigation they're working on and input the type of offense. For example, along with the code, they might select kidnapping or motor vehicle theft. Langley hopes this will stop officers from making up false reasons or inputting something overly vague, such as investigation. Audit assistance will be mandatory for all police departments using Flock. The tool flags abnormal search behavior, such as an officer repeatedly searching the same license plate day after day, or clusters of searches late at night. Users are locked out in real time until an administrator reviews the search. Data will be retained in the system for 7 days instead of 30 days, except for cases that need more time under evidence mode when a search is tied to an ongoing case number. And departments can choose what type of cases can be searched for by other departments. For example, Department A might allow Department B to search its cameras for kidnapping, homicide, or theft cases, but exclude Department B from searching for immigration-related offenses. And our last front page story is about the Middle East, headlined U.S. and Iran each claim to hold the strait. This is a Reuters story, datelined Dubai. The Strait of Hormuz is under Iran's control and management, the recently appointed head of Iran's Basij paramilitary unit said Thursday, a day after U.S. President Donald Trump claimed the United States had total control of the strategic waterway. Hossein Tayyib said the U.S. sought to disrupt what he described as the Islamic Republic's popularity in the region by launching another war in the Strait of Hormuz, but was defeated despite claiming Iran had neither an air force nor a navy. Today you see that the Strait of Hormuz is under the management and control of the Islamic Republic, Tayyib said, according to the semi-official Fars News. After the start of the war, which began with U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran on February 28th, Tehran effectively shut the strait, through which a fifth of the world's oil and liquefied natural gas was previously shipped. The U.S. subsequently imposed a naval blockade on Iranian shipping and ports while saying it would protect freedom of navigation for vessels traveling to and from non-Iranian ports. Iran's Joint Military Command, Qatam al-Anbiya Central Headquarters, said later Thursday that no vessel could transit the Strait of Hormuz without Tehran's permission. The baseless claims made by the United States regarding the normal passage of vessels through the Strait of Hormuz are nothing more than lies and falsehoods, the command said in a statement published by state media. In June, the two countries reached an interim agreement declaring a permanent ceasefire and calling for a swift return to freedom of navigation in the Gulf. The deal unraveled a few weeks later after Iran resumed limited attacks on vessels that it said were sailing contrary to the arrangements under the agreement, prompting the U.S. to restart strikes on Iran's southern promises, which Washington said were aimed at degrading Tehran's ability to target vessels in the Gulf. Separately on Thursday, senior military political official Rasul Saneh Rad said that Iran would not reopen the strait unless the other side fulfilled its commitments under the interim deal, adding that the reopening of the waterway was not something the U.S. can achieve unilaterally, according to Fars News. Saneh Rad also warned Iran would respond more forcefully in any future conflict, saying, in a possible future war, we will stand more firmly and more offensively. And we turn now to some local and state news. This story is headlined, Driver Dies in Crash in DeWitt County, Dateline Clinton. A driver was killed in a single vehicle crash early Wednesday near the DeWitt-Logan County line, DeWitt County Coroner Randall J. Rice said. Kalen J. Sanchez was pronounced dead at the scene at 2 a.m. on Illinois Route 10 West, Rice said in a news release. The investigation, which also involves the Illinois State Police, is ongoing with an autopsy scheduled, Rice said. Additional information on Sanchez and the circumstances of the crash were not released. And this story is headlined, Sorensen seeks $1.25 million for the Central Illinois Regional Airport. Dateline, Bloomington. Congressman Eric Sorensen, Democrat of Moline, visited the Central Illinois Regional Airport on Thursday to announce a $1.25 million federal funding request to support improvements to the airport's boarding bridges. Of the eight gates at the airport, one has a passenger boarding bridge that is unrepairable and non-functioning because its manufacturer no longer exists. Another boarding bridge does not have full compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act, so it can only accommodate aircraft with no more than 50 seats. Sorensen said, to meet the demands of the next generation, the airport will need jet bridges that can accommodate bigger aircraft. This becomes even more important with the growth of Delta Airlines and increased service between Bloomington and Atlanta. Community project funding is all about investing in projects that communities identify as immediate priorities, Sorensen said. These aren't Washington ideas, these are local ideas with local support as we're able to immediately fulfill and serve new people. Carl Olson, the airport's executive director, said part of the project would be to replace the non-functional bridge with a new unit capable of supporting large aircraft. The tunnel of the other bridge that is not ADA compliant would be extended so it can reach larger aircraft. Sorensen thanked U.S. Representative Darren LaHood, Republican of Dunlap, for providing a letter of support that led to the project being eligible for more funding than he expected. LaHood was also instrumental in securing funding for the airport's cargo road expansion, Sorensen said. This is a great example of what we can accomplish when we work together with bipartisanship and priorities that benefit everyone, he said. Will Attig, downtown regional director for Senator Tammy Duckworth, said the senator has also submitted a $1.5 million request after this project to continue the growth of the airport. Olson said once the grant opportunity comes through, the airport can move forward with the design phase immediately. After the project goes out to bid and a contract is approved, construction and installation would take 15 to 18 months depending on the weather. Additional capital projects underway at the airport include a full excavation of the center of the short-term parking lot with milling and overlay of the outer areas and rehabilitation of the main exit lane in the long-term lot. Last year, the airport received $12.5 million in federal funding for its runway rehabilitation project, which includes pavement repairs and the installation of new runway lights, signs, and other safety enhancements. Olson said it's nice to be able to do all of this work for the community. That's the only function of the Airport Authority, is to operate the airport for the benefit of the community, Olson said. If we are not doing that, we are not doing our jobs, so it's wonderful to be a part of it. Alan Sender, chairman of the Airport Authority Board, said there are almost 1.9 million people living within 90 minutes of the airport, and its commercial air service attracts passengers from 40 counties in Illinois each year. As the largest employer at the airport, FedEx handles packages heading to and from 20 counties throughout central Illinois, he added. And here is the calendar of events. Hill of a Race, 8 a.m. to noon, August 15th at Ewing Park 2 on Ethel Parkway in Bloomington. Join us for the Ultimate Outdoor Fitness Challenge in Bloomington. Pet Central Helps and Pet Smart Adoption Event, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., August 15th and 16th at PetSmart on East Empire Street in Bloomington. Come see Pet Central Helps every weekend at PetSmart in Bloomington with a large variety of available pets. Project 15 Museum 5th Annual Outdoor Festival, 4 p.m. August 15th at the Legacy Building on West Front Street in El Paso. Exploration, live music, keynote address, dancing and karaoke, food, games, and community. And the Wet Hot American Summer Fest, 5 to 10 p.m. August 15th at the Normal Theater on West North Street in Normal, celebrating the 25th anniversary, featuring themed games, food, and a screening of the film. Showtimes at 7 and 9:45 p.m. August 14th and 2 p.m. August 15th. Joseph Rodney, Freedom Seeker on the Illinois Central Railroad, presented by Daryl Dexter, from 1:30 to 3 p.m. August 16th at the C.H. Moore Homestead in DeWitt County Museum on East Woodlawn Street in Clinton. The DeWitt County Museum Association is proud to welcome author and historian Daryl Dexter, who will present Joseph Rodney, Freedom Seeker on the Illinois Central Railroad. Neurofitness Yoga, 4 to 5 p.m., August 19th through October 7th, at the Carl Health and Fitness Center on Trinity Lane in Bloomington. A neuro-based yoga class is a specialized yoga program that caters to individuals facing a variety of neurological challenges. Safely engage in yoga postures, breathing exercise. And the Miller Park Zoo Sensory Tour, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., August 20th, at the Miller Park Zoo on South Morris Avenue in Bloomington. Miller Park Zoo proudly offers a new opportunity for those with sensory sensitivities. And Mark Aubert, 7 p.m. August 21st at the BMET Country Opera at North State Street in Monticello. Doors open at 6 p.m., $10 per person. And here is Susan Haslett's column titled Never Too Soon for Pumpkin Spice. My husband says the official pumpkin spice season does not start for a few more weeks. He insists it's still corn on the cob season and points to the calendar. As if cinnamon and nutmeg care what date it is. But I am ready now, and I have been since July, when the summer heat made me dream of cooler days, cozy sweaters, and that familiar spiced aroma drifting from my coffee mug. The fall flavor fete is here, and I have proof. 3 bags of pumpkin spice coated pretzels from Sam's Club are sitting in my pantry. 3. I bought the first bag as a reasonable person might, a small seasonal indulgence, a toe dipped into autumn's waters. The second bag was purchased because the first disappeared faster than I care to admit, and the third, well, that's just good planning. And this morning I found a single pumpkin spice coffee pod left over from last season wedged behind the decaf choices in the Keurig drawer. You would have thought I struck gold. I actually gasped. I held the lost pod up to the light, like a prospector examining a nugget pulled from a riverbed. My husband walked through the kitchen, saw my face, and just kept walking. He knows better than to come between me and a brewing cup of pumpkin spice coffee. Yes, I am one of those women. You know, the ones we are frequently teased, occasionally mocked, and always underestimated in our devotion to this particular flavor profile. We are the reason the pumpkin spice industrial complex exists, and I am not ashamed. I wear this identity like a badge, or perhaps more accurately, like a cinnamon-dusted sweater. Our local grocery store shelf stocker has promised a delivery of pumpkin spice bagels any day now. I'm not sure how he knows to tell me this. I suspect my enthusiasm has preceded me, possibly at a volume that carries across the bread aisle. Maybe he remembers my excitement from last year. I also cannot wait for my first box of limited edition pumpkin spice Cheerios, which I will eat with the kind of reverence usually reserved for Thanksgiving dinner. It's not just me. It appears the world is catching the fever earlier than ever. Starbucks just announced their pumpkin spice latte returns August 25th. They're adding an iced pumpkin cream shaken espresso and a pumpkin spice chai to the lineup. And Little Debbie is rolling out pumpkin spice mini muffins and pumpkin spice oatmeal cream pies beginning this week. The industry knows what I already knew. Fans are not waiting for the fall equinox to feel autumnal. The old timelines don't apply. If you can wear white after Labor Day, you can enjoy pumpkin spice before the gas grill runs out of propane. However, I am not without standards. For example, I am not a big fan of pumpkin spice beer. I mean, you have to draw the line somewhere, right? There is something about the marriage of hops and nutmeg that does not work for me. I'll take my autumn flavor in a mug, a bowl, or a bakery bag, but not a pint glass. My husband watches all of this with the bemused patience of an engineer examining a system he cannot optimize. He knows pumpkin spice season is not just about ground cinnamon, nutmeg, ginger, cloves, and allspice. It's my favorite time of year. The turning of the leaves, the reliability of harvest rituals, and the comfort of crisper days. Or maybe it really is just about the pretzels. The official beginning of fall is not for 5 entire weeks yet, but in my kitchen, in my coffee cup, and in my heart, it has already arrived. And here is today's Flick Fact question. Everyone is curious what everyone else makes at their job. Can you name the average salary in McLean County of these following professions? And the answer is, according to ZipRecruiter of McLean County, a CEO makes $118,066, a minister $58,420, a computer programmer $62,325, a court reporter $77,267, a dentist $201,570, a surgeon $418,004, a content editor $80,397, and a human resources manager $117,280. And this story is headlined, School Sanitation Products Collected, Dateline Lincoln. Area lawmakers are hosting a classroom care drive through September 30th to collect essential supplies that keep schools germ-free. The event is hosted by State Senator Sally Turner, Republican of Beeson, and Republican State Representatives Reagan Deering of Decatur and Representative Bill Hauter of Morton. Acceptable items include tissues, hand sanitizer, wet wipes for hands, Clorox wipes, and paper towels. Donations can be dropped off at Turner's district office at 120 South McLean Street, Suite E in Lincoln, Deering's district office at 419 East Ash Avenue, Decatur, and Hauter's district office at 133 South Main Street, Suite A in Morton. Drop-off hours are 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Lincoln, 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday in Decatur, and 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday in Morton. And this story is headlined, ICE agent admits hitting protester. This is from the Chicago Tribune. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent on Wednesday pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor count of battery for throwing a protester to the ground while he filmed the agent on his phone. Adam Sirocco, 41, entered the plea during a court appearance in Maywood and was sentenced to 1 year of supervision. He is thought to be the first and only immigration agent charged in Cook County in connection with conduct toward protesters and civilians during Operation Midway Blitz. He was off duty at the time of the confrontation. And advocates and community members have applied pressure to the state's attorney, asking her to pursue charges against agents for alleged wrongdoing during the aggressive immigration enforcement operation this past fall. The state's attorney, though, has said that her office can only file charges for on-duty incidents in narrow circumstances and must be referred cases by law enforcement. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Panagraph of Friday, August 14th, 2026. I look forward to reading part two with you next.